Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. It has been another action-packed week of Arsenal news, stories, events, happenings and goings-on. Oh yeah. Well, it hasn't really because, well, have we signed any players? Have we sold any players? So, you know, there you go. In fairness, it is still only mid-June.
It's still good.
But, you know, time is ticking and we have got a lot to do in a relatively short period of time. It's only 2 months before the new season begins. It's just over 3 weeks until pre-season begins. I know. That's what this extended end of the season has done. It's brought everything all closer together. That's something I'm going to be talking about with my guest now in a few minutes' time. Philippe Auclair will be with me to talk about FIFA and UEFA and the game of football itself and the impact that vested interests are having on the decisions that are governing the game and shaping the future of the game. That's all to come. And we do, of course, talk Arsenal as well about recruitment and transfers and Unai Emery and Stan Kroenke and lots of other stuff besides. As ever, it's an interesting, fascinating, in-depth conversation with Philippe, and that is the bulk of our show today, because really there isn't a great deal else going on. There is, of course, the Premier League fixtures. They came out. We start our Premier League campaign for 2019-20 against Newcastle away from home. Our first home game is Burnley, followed by a trip to Anfield on the 24th of August, and on the 31st of August, we've got Tottenham Hotspur at home. So it's not what you would call an easy start to the season. And then when I look at the rest of the fixtures from September to May, I look at them and I think, wow, they're all pretty tough games. Yep, that's a tough game. That's a tough game. That's a tough game. That's a difficult game. That one's, yeah, tricky. That could be a bit of a banana skin there. I think it is because of where we are and what we are right at this moment in time, because we have so many concerns about the team, about the way that the team needs to be rebuilt, about the work that needs to be done in the transfer market. So right now, it's all looking quite difficult. It might look a little less difficult at the start of the season when we have signed some players. This is a little gap there for you to insert your own canned laughter. No, we will, of course. We will sign some players. It depends what kind of players that we sign. How good are they going to be? Are they the right players? Will those players allow us to play football better than we did last season? I.e. defend better and possibly attack better and maybe midfield a bit better. That would be good. Our goalkeeper, he was quite good, so maybe we don't need to improve there. But yeah, at the moment, it's all up in the air and it all feels a little bit unstable, and we don't quite know enough about the people who are doing the work this summer to have any faith in them. But I suppose the flip side of that is that we possibly, perhaps, maybe have to give them a little bit of time to show us what they can do. Although when you read that Denis Suarez arrived at Arsenal completely unfit and even after 2 weeks was not even 50% fit, you have to question some of the decision-making and why we did that particular deal. I know it's not an outlier completely in the world of Arsenal, because we did, of course, sign Kim Schellstrom with a broken back, and we knew he had a broken back, and we went and we signed him anyway. But I'm not necessarily sure that's a tradition that you should maintain. That might just be the kind of thing you don't particularly want to do. So, look, I'm going to talk to Philippe a bit about all that as well. The other story that caught my eye this week from an Arsenal point of view was the fact that one of our academy coaches was banned for 3 games and fined £400 for abusing a referee after a game. He called the referee a little prick after the referee refused to shake his hand because he had, throughout the course of the game, been shouting abuse and shouting things and getting on the referee's case. The kicker here is that the game was an under-9s match between Reading and Arsenal, under-9s, and the referee was a teenage girl. I mean, really? I know football can be a bit full-on, and there's pressure, and a competitive, pressurised environment is good. Young players have to get used to that. And we've all seen the parents, the sideline coaches, you know, who take it all way too seriously. But fucking hell. This is under-9s. And this was a teenage girl who was reduced to tears by this grown man bellowing at her from the sidelines. Arsenal say they don't condone any kind of behaviour like that, but the guy is no longer the head coach of the under-9s. Apparently he's got more general coaching duties. But, you know, someone needs to have a word. That guy could well have some issues with his anger. Because if that's the way you behave when you have a responsibility and you're representing Arsenal, regardless of what age level it is, if that's the way you behave, someone needs to have a quiet word with you or, you know, a boot in your arse and put you straight out the door. Right, let's get on with the show. And as ever, when Philippe is here, we're in store for some excellent, fascinating football chat. And I'm sure today will be no different. Philippe, hello.
Thank you very much. I hope I live up to this.
Well, I have no doubts whatsoever. I'm not trying to heap any pressure on you or anything like that. We are going to talk about Arsenal. We're obviously going to talk about Arsenal, but we were due to talk last week. And something came up, and the something that came up was the arrest of the head of the Confederation of African Football. And you were at the FIFA annual congress last week, and I have to say I'm curious about what your reaction was when Gianni Infantino, the man who was re-elected as the head of FIFA unopposed, he spoke about how FIFA had been transformed from being toxic, almost criminal, to being what it should be, an organization that develops football. The governing body, FIFA, is now synonymous with credibility, trust, integrity, equality, and human rights. Can I ask how loud the laugh was in the room when he said that?
In the gallery, yes, which is where the journalists were. Apart from them, there were 3 guys sat next to me who actually applauded him. I think they had been planted. There was some kind of clack, you know. In fairness, the representatives of the 200-plus federations who were in Paris for the Congress didn't really give him the hero's welcome that you might expect, because the whole thing was redolent of a ceremony either in Moscow 1937 or Pyongyang 2019. And, you know, I'll leave you the choice between Stalin and Kim Jong-il. But we were wondering if the applause would die down after 30 seconds, 5 minutes, or as the case was with Stalin, something 11 minutes, because nobody wanted to be the person who stopped clapping, for obvious reason. In this particular case, the applause was polite, but not fervor was missing, I would say.
Sure.
And we were just going through the motions. And to be honest, it was not the most edifying of spectacles. The whole charade of Infantino leaving the room for the election when everybody knew he was the only candidate, when it had been put to the Congress that they would change the statutes there and then to allow an election by acclamation without a vote, which is honestly something that made me feel sick in my stomach. And the very idea that people would be able to countenance that shows that, if anything, FIFA has regressed compared to what it was under Joseph Blatter.
Sure, and that's a low bar. That's a very low bar.
That's pretty. But I think, you know, what happened under Blatter after the scandal of the attribution of World Cup to Qatar in particular, there was a genuine desire to reform within the organization. And anyway, they didn't have any choice because the les flics were knocking on everybody's door quite quickly. And the intervention of the police, various authorities and the media, the extraordinary pressure of the media, as well as a genuine will to reform from within some quarters of the federation, made that we had, and I wouldn't say a transparent FIFA, but we had a FIFA on the right way, on the right path for about 2-3 years, and then it went pear-shaped, and then there was the election. Infantino won, and as I never tire from reminding everybody, one of the first things he did when he arrived at the head of FIFA was to disband the anti-racism task force by saying that its job was done. That he's also the man who sacked absolutely almost every single person who had been here before him and who had a modicum of independence, particularly in the areas of compliance, ethics, both investigation and jurisdiction and so on. And he basically has created a monster, which is in his image. He's obviously a very clever man, a very intelligent man. He's not somebody whom you could attack in the same way that you could attack the old guard, who were all quite, you know, colorful figure. You think of Chuck Blazer with his parrot on his mobility scooter in Central Park. You think of Jack Warner. You think even of Jeffrey Webb in his luxurious palatial home. And you could carry on like that. I mean, it was such a gallery of rogues. These guys are more technocrats, and he's a lawyer, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah, but that's almost a bit more sinister, isn't it? Because a guy going around on a mobility scooter with a parrot on his shoulder, at least there's something overt about that. There's something overt about a guy who's living in luxury and what have you. But, you know, behind the scenes to disband, you know, something as fundamental as the Task Force Against Racism and to do away with people who might provide some modicum of accountability and everything else,
yeah,
that's far more sinister. And I think what was quite interesting is, as he's talking about this, as we were due to talk last week, a big story broke, and you've just published something on the BBC this morning about how President Ahmad, who's the head of the Confederation of African Football, has been arrested. So while Infantino is talking about how it's no longer associated with all these terrible things that we associate with FIFA, we have this going on.
Yeah, I mean, I must immediately add that he was taken for questioning and then released without charge, which anyway was probably the only thing that the French authorities could do at this particular stage anyway. Mm-hmm. But he was released without charge. And it's I won't go into details of why he was taken into questioning by French police. Go to the BBC website and have a look at my story, which I wrote with Piers Edwards and Paul Udegaard, and expect more in the days to come.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that story in the show notes for this episode. So if anyone's looking for it,
it was quite extraordinary because after the Congress, I went to the Hyatt Regency, which is where all the African delegates were staying, and the atmosphere was absolutely electric. People knew, I mean, to be honest, within the microcosm, we had an idea that something was about to happen, but nobody had seen it happening like that as dramatically as it was. So we have, and you know, by the way, President Ahmad is a very close ally of Gianni Infantino. President Ahmad supported Gianni Infantino in his campaign, and President Infantino supported Ahmad, and not half, believe me, in his bid to become CAF president. So they're linked. And it will be interesting to see how it plays out. If, you know, there are loads of rumors circulating, which I really can't comment, which is really, I'm biting my tongue because I've been working on this for 9 months, Andrew. So, but, you know, you've got to be careful. But in any case, no, you know, we're not out of the woods. But I would say that in a way, if there are, and I'm not talking about Ahmad specifically here, still suggestions of misdemeanors, corruption, whatever you want to call it, in various parts of FIFA. For me, that's not the most serious part of it. What we've only got to look at is the eventual outcome. If you've got a couple of rotten apples in as big a basket as this one and where is so much money to be fished out, that's not very much a surprise to me. On the other hand, when you're talking about literally transforming the whole of the game, not for the usual kind of crooks and criminals, even though, but for streaming platforms, nation states which want to polish their image, money launderers on huge scales and the rest of it, when you're thinking about transforming the sporting calendar to an extent that it will be unrecognizable, and then you will open yourself to every single pressure that you can think of. And there was an extraordinary moment when Infantino defended, you know, the famous $25 billion deal that FIFA, you know, which is basically all about the revamping of the Club World Cup, which is an insane, which is about all these new competitions and the World Nations League and all these things. And at the end of it, what is the reason for that? Is it sporting? Of course not. It's $25 billion. And Tariq Panjab of the New York Times suggested quite strongly that this money was actually coming via a Japanese bank, but from Saudi interests. So this I find far more interesting, in a way, and far more sinister. And of course, what Infantino said, they said, oh no, of course not, we've just done things as we always do them, you know, we put things for tender, we use agencies, we've always done that. Would you imagine that I would be crazy enough to sell the rights to FIFA competitions? And I was thinking, well, of course you would. Yeah, you would find a way.
Of course.
It might not, you might not look like this on the paper, but that's exactly what you would do, because if you take $25 billion from whoever it is, you're obviously going to be submitted to a certain pressure, shall I say, to do what these people want you to do. And for example, at the moment, believe it or not, and I hope it's just a crazy rumor that's doing the rounds, there is talk about the use of VAR. I mean, I'm not saying this is true, guys. Okay, don't, you know, we started many rumors here. And with success, Andrew.
Yeah, munchy.
But the fact of using VAR, referrals to VARs as a means to put more advertising during the game?
Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? VAR, sponsored by Omega Watches, sponsored by Specsavers, sponsored by whoever it might be. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, maybe and, it's not, maybe it's not from, the exact reason that they want to implement it, but it's certainly something else that can be exploited for the commercial side of the game.
Absolutely. And as well, the old ideas of having, instead of having two half times, to have three third times or four quarters. I know, I hear your sigh. But this, and because you think, well, anything is possible because the calendar has basically been ripped. You know, the changes which had been brought to it had been incremental. As in, for example, what Lennart Johansson did with the Champions League, it was incremental. It was, you know, it took its time to get where we are now, where we actually think we probably have got, you know, about, I mean, apart from the money is shared, which should be far more equal and fair, it's actually a great competition. And so, yeah. But this is different. This is taking the book, tearing it, asking people who've got loads of money, what would you like, and doing it.
Do you feel like that is part of a... I mean, I don't want to delve into the realms of conspiracies here or anything like that, but there are vested interests who look at football and, you know, who certainly have looked at football over the last 20, 30 years and seen an industry which is underdeveloped and ripe for exploitation. And we've seen that. We can all see it in how football is these days because of the advent of the Premier League and broadcasting revenues and the globalization of the Premier League, but also the sport itself. And some people might say, well, we're at a saturation point already. There's not much more that anybody can do.
No.
But it feels to me like this as you talked about, a lot of these changes were incremental, and many of them were beneficial for fans because we all got to see more football. We could watch more football. It was on TV, and now we can stream it and all those things. And it has created a global football community of Arsenal fans, United fans, Liverpool fans. We can all communicate, and the advent of the internet has played into this. But, you know, this week, Philippe, it's the middle of June, and they're still playing European Championship qualifiers.
Yeah. Start the Champions League qualifiers as well.
Exactly. So
and more... we had as well. Sorry to interrupt you, Andrew, but the thing which was very, very disappointing. The Nations League was fantastic when it went on during the qualifiers. I really, really enjoyed that, and I completely forgot about the friendlies and so forth. The final tournament was a huge disappointment. Yeah. Not in the quality of the football, but nobody seemed to care at all about it. And in fairness, those European qualifiers. I mean, I know I was working on my piece, you know, my investigation, and they completely passed me by. I didn't even know they were happening. Well, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, I mean,
thought,
does it feel to you like football is being squeezed into something that won't operate on a season by season basis, but on something of an annual basis, a calendar year, because we are going to have this interruption for the World Cup in Qatar in 2022. That is going to mean domestic seasons have a great big gap in them. And I personally cannot see how that is anything other than completely damaging to the game in England and across Europe. And the reasons why the World Cup has gone there, that's a completely different debate. But it feels like, you know, even with the prominence of preseason tournaments and competitions and tours these days, that a sort of legitimacy is being lent to those, which comes from people perhaps who have a vested interest in the overall in football becoming more of a year-round thing. So the gap that we get, or the break that we all kind of, you know, enjoyed from football during the summer, will no longer be part of the process or part of the calendar, because the demand is there. The people will exploit the demand, and what happens is we'll just get football staggered across 12 months of the year.
Yeah, and basically follow the money. And where is the money coming from? It's coming from China, it's coming from the Gulf, and it's coming from the States. So, and the people who've got the money are the people who will finally decide. And I'm very interested to see what's going to happen for 2026, for example, which is, of course, USA, Canada, Mexico. And then we've got 2030, where the rules are not quite. We don't know where the World Cup is going to go there, because everything, of course, is, you know, locked into the World Cup, which is, you know, generates more money than any other thing. We still don't know, for example, if China will be able to present its candidacy. In which case, if that's allowed, well, we can already prepare our passports if we want to go. I'm not sure I want to go, but yeah, I agree with you. It's the model. It's the NBAization or the NFLization, and it might be that we football fans find ourselves in a situation that many people find themselves in American sports, which is, oh, sod it with the big leagues. I'm interested in my university. I'm interested in my local minor league and so forth. And I meet more and more people who honestly can't be bothered about the bigger picture or the big things if it goes down that way. I mean, personally, I know I wouldn't, I don't know. I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be that interested either.
It would certainly taint the experience, you know, and maybe getting older and a bit more cynical plays a part in that, but I also think there are fundamentals about football and the game of football that the people who run FIFA and the people who run UEFA, their first job is to protect those things. And I feel, and I'm
but to them, they're not things which must be protected. They're assets which must be sold.
I get that. But this is where I have a problem with it, because we all fall in love with the game, or we, you know, we all have our own experience, and we've all grown up in different eras, and we've all grown up in football being presented to us in different ways. But ultimately, what the job of a games governing body or a sports governing body is to protect the well-being of the sport and the people who play that sport and the people who enjoy that sport, not to create even more wealth for the already obscenely wealthy. And it's somehow, this has become the priority for FIFA and for UEFA and even for the Premier League, that the decisions that they make more and more and more. And look, we've experienced it even this season, haven't we, with Arsenal and Baku and Mkhitaryan and all those kind of things where fans, I mean, I think we're used to fans being an afterthought, but even clubs and players have become an afterthought in the decision-making process because they're secondary. They're secondary to what they think really matters, which is generating revenue and generating wealth.
Which is why one of the few pockets of resistance is coming from the players, the players' organization, because they simply don't want, I mean, with this crazy calendar that Gianni and Infantino, but also Ceferin at UEFA, because there's a kind of tug of war between the two, and tug of love at times, but especially tug of war. Some players would have to play literally every 72 hours over a period of several months, which is just insane. It can't be. You can't do that. You want them to get injured, they will get injured. Don't worry about that. And when you think, we're talking about a 24-club World Cup and nobody knows who's going to be in there and when you're going to play it, well, you've got a vague idea of when you're going to play it. It's true because the next two are in Qatar, so there you go. But after the reform, we don't know exactly at the moment what's going to happen. But I think whichever way the coins which have been thrown in the air fall, it's going to be bad for us.
Yes.
I know it. It's going to be the buttered toast theory all over again. It always falls on the wrong side. I'm sorry. The amount of money which is at stake is such. And as well, we've had a complete transformation of the people who are now investing into the game. And the fact that nation states are doing it is for me the most worrying of them all.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad to have people coming from companies that perhaps are not as transparent as you would like to get involved in football. It's not particularly new either, but to see nation states get into it and actually play a major role. It's not just like, oh, we're going to have 3 years in this club and then bugger off. No, we're in there to own it.
Yes. And do you think, I know we're speculating here, but when we talk about those kind of club owners, this idea perhaps that people have that their only desire is to present themselves in this sanitized, PR-driven way and to make their club the most successful club in the world. I mean, that to me seems a little bit simplistic. It feels like they have bigger fish to fry in terms of the way they want to influence the game itself and not just the clubs that they own.
Indeed, and which is why you had all the kerfuffle around the expansion of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar to 48 countries. This was very much driven by countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates via Gianni Infantino and a representation by CONMEBOL, the South American Confederation. This is the way it works in FIFA. It's incomprehensible, but that's the way it works. And it was just part of the current war because there is a war at the moment going on there. And it's a war which is not fought with tanks and jet planes, thankfully, not yet anyway. But it's a diplomatic war. It's a blockade. It's and football is very much a weapon to be used to humiliate the Qataris, which was the objective of the Saudis and the Emiratis. And it hasn't been possible to do so. But that's what football has become. And it's not just one example of it. I think that you'll be able to see similar examples of not perhaps to the same extent elsewhere, not just in the Gulf. And also, this war is fought, so to speak, by proxy via the clubs which those countries have bought and will buy. Because, I mean, every day almost, I mean, I know there are some crazy theories going around about we're going to be bought by this, we're going to be bought by that. But they're looking for clubs. They're looking for clubs to buy. I mean, Manchester City, it's not just Manchester City. It's also, they've got a club in Uruguay, they've got a club in Australia, they've got a club in Spain, they've got a club in the US and so on.
Australia too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so you and it's going to be the same with other owners of this type. The Qataris, you know, they've also got Casa Open in Belgium. And we could carry on like that.
Yeah.
So and it's a real danger. And in a way, what we do when we open the door to investments as huge as the ones that Infantino was mentioning, is that we basically are saying to these people, well, why don't you do exactly what you want to do as long as you give us the money?
Yeah. Well, look, this is a discussion that could go on, and I think it's one that's going to be prevalent throughout the football world in the months and years to come. But for today, we'll leave it there with that, because I do want to talk to you about Arsenal. So from one depressing topic, we'll move to another one.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I know you have been tied up with your investigation and the piece that you've written for the BBC, and I don't know how much time you've had to consider the state of play at Arsenal this
summer.
I've still
had too much time. Yeah. To do that. Yes.
Yeah. How do you view the work that we have to do, or the quantity of work that we as a club have to do between now, the 14th of June, this is the broadcast day, we're talking on the 13th of June, but we're mid-June, and the Premier League starts in just under 2 months' time. We've seen the fixtures. Arsenal have got Newcastle on the opening day, and a couple of very early tricky fixtures against Liverpool and Tottenham in there as well. You know, there is a lot to do in a very short space of time. How are you viewing our ability to get what needs to be done done?
Well, I think the first way you phrased the question was, what do we do? And for me, the first question is, who are we? And I'm not so sure about who this we is. That's a strange sentence.
I know what you mean. Like, by we, I mean, of course, Arsenal, the royal we, which includes
the chain of command, decides what,
sure.
This vacuum there's been, the fact that, you know, after the Europa League final, I think we were not even disappointed. We were kind of a state of numbness.
Mm.
I don't know. Speak for myself here and my friends. But it's difficult to see exactly how we can address the immediate problems, which are basically the squad. The main problem is the squad. But we do, when I say the main problem is the squad, the main problem is the fact that we don't have the money to change much in that squad, for a simple reason, is that the turnover of the club is decreasing from season to season. And we went from 422 million to 388. We're going down the list of the sort of rich list of Deloitte's. And it's not a question of cocking a snook at the neighbors and say, we're richer than you are. It's a question that money talks, and that when you hear about a war chest, so to speak, of £40 million net, that's absolutely bugger all. That is nothing.
Sure.
So we know that, and also I have been a little bit I'm a bit worried by listening to what some of our players are saying. You know, they're with the national teams, or were with the national teams, or will be with the national teams in the case of those going to the AFCON and Copa America. You've probably seen what Lucas Torreira was quoted as saying. I didn't really like that, even if I understood it. You have heard the noises made by the Aubameyang camp. You've heard the noises made by Alexandre Lacazette. And you think, oh, God, we could do without that. And it's not nice. It's not good. And we still don't see how we're going to sort out the Ozil situation.
That's
a big problem. It's a huge problem because we're talking about a lot of money and also the effect it has on the squad, the team, and the club as a whole. People have been talking about some targets, and we'll come to that in a minute, and been linked with some kind of targets, some of which, you know, actually I think actually would be decent buys, but perhaps not for 2019-2020. Andrew, I don't see a strategy in place. I might be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. And I don't see means in place unless some, shall we say, rather left field choices are made in terms of perhaps disposing with personnel.
Do you mean personnel or
something? Well, I'm going to put it to you. A very good friend of mine, been a season ticket holder for decades, said, okay, don't kill me, but maybe the only way we can generate some money is by selling players, in which case we should be selling Aubameyang. Wow.
It is a common debate at the moment on Twitter. It's a question myself and James get asked on the Arscast Extra all the time.
Really?
Should we sell, you know, one of our key assets in order to rebuild? And, you know, when you step back from it objectively, you can look and say, well, maybe that is a way. And maybe that's how we have to do it. The question that I have, certainly the one that sets alarm bells ringing in my head, is that, okay, maybe selling Aubameyang to China, and let's say you get £70 million for him. Well, let's even speculate and say we get £80 million, and we can add that to our whopping £40 million budget that we have anyway, right? The thing that worries me more than anything is who's fucking spending that money. Right? I mean, do you trust them to spend 120 million more than you trust them to spend 40 million? I mean, I was thinking about this morning and you know, some of the decisions that are being made at this football club, I wonder if they are being made for really the right reasons. In that, you know, as we spoke about with FIFA and UEFA, surely the decisions you make should be for the overall benefit of your football club. Even if it's a little bit more expensive, the right decision is the right decision. And I think about Sven Mislintat leaving the club and as yet not officially replaced. That's a head of recruitment that went in February. Everyone knew he was going in January, and the club probably knew that before. We have Francis Cajigao, who was our scout in Spain under the previous scouting setup, which, as I'm sure you know, and I've spoken about on this podcast and on the website, is or has been dysfunctional is a good way of putting it, but a shambles at other times might be a way of putting it too. So we have a guy who's being put in place as the ostensible head of recruitment, who's part of a previous setup that has not worked, and we needed to go in a different direction. And it feels to me like that decision is being made because he is the most, if we want to put it diplomatically, the most cost-effective replacement, right? Rather than the best guy for the job. I mean, this is a Philippa football club that is advertising for a scout in Italy on Twitter. I mean, what the fuck is that? What is that?
I don't know.
You know, it's so even if you sell Aubameyang and you put it in an ideal situation where you go, we will use that money to reinvest and we can buy eight £12 million players from Ligue 2 because they're all players of great potential. I don't have any faith, or certainly none of us have any evidence that the people who are making the decisions at this football club on an operational basis, on a squad building basis, on a background basis, the technical structure of the club, we've no evidence whatsoever that they're any good at doing any of those things. So that's where my worry about selling Aubameyang comes in.
Okay, well, that's a very powerful argument, and I'll remember it. I'll remember every word of it, and I'll say that to my friend when I meet him next, which is tomorrow. I'll explain to him the truth of the matter. The fact is, if you look at the top of the club, I think Salieri is probably the only person whom you could qualify as a genuine football person, somebody who's got great wealth of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly has done, you know, a very good job in his previous capacity at Barcelona. Yes, I'm with you, and I'm worried as well. I'm looking over my shoulder because I feel that there are clubs which are just behind Arsenal at the moment, which have got a far better setup and perhaps more ambition as well, sporting ambition, which goes with sometimes spending more money. Now, the thing I have to say, by the way, is that I don't quite understand why this war chest is £40 million. I must say I don't understand it. And this figure has been, you know, put out and everywhere, and nobody at the club is actually saying, oh no, it's completely untrue, as they used to do. You remember in the good old days, no, Arsene has got all the money he wants.
Yeah.
Nobody has gone down that line that way so far.
Keeping our cards close to our chest, perhaps. If you were being, you know, we don't want to show the world how much we've really got. But I mean, I think it's based on accounting figures. The Arsenal Supporters Trust this week have done a very deep dive into the finances and the loss that we are projected to make. And on top of, you know, the money that we have spent. I mean, I think one of the things that...
But 40 million quid. I mean, yeah. let's get into a bit of detail. Let's say, okay, I've got 40 million I'm going to pay. And people think, oh, it means I can pay 40 million for a player. No. Let's say you buy, I don't know, a player who costs 40 million. He's going to the way it's going to be accounted is that the way it's sold is going to be accounted over the 4 or 5 seasons on the stay at the club. Okay.
Yeah.
So when we say 40 million, already you think, well, okay, maybe not. Net in total, possibly. But we should be looking at far more than that. I mean, this is why, for example, Everton were able to go on this spending spree last summer. Remember, when they spent a lot of money. So I'm a little bit puzzled by that. But the problem is that everything I hear seems to confirm that indeed this is the figure. That's what actually baffles me. We are in a situation at the moment where we won't be in the Champions League again. And you're thinking, and maybe again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very slippery slope. The turnover is going down. The wages bill at the moment is pretty stable, which means it's really hurting more and more and more. And we've got, and when you look at the season we've had, you actually, I find it very difficult to qualify it. I talk in the Premier League. We had this extraordinary series of results at the beginning of the season when, you know, all these this series of undefeated games, some of which were a little bit on the lucky side, shall we say? But, you know, we carried on. And you thought this is going to be a springboard, and it was not a springboard. We actually fell from the springboard and realized the pool was empty, and which is what happened at the end of the season. And I'm seeing here the dynamics are really worrying to me, the sporting dynamics, but also the fact that behind I can see that there are clubs, and the clubs are Everton, the clubs are Leicester, the clubs are Wolves, obviously, which have got a bit of money to spend, and seemingly a very different dynamic and momentum to ours.
Mm. So, I mean, is your concern here when you talk about those things and you talk about the budget and you talk about our income, our turnover decreasing, our continued, we're now, I guess, established in many ways as a Europa League club rather than being a Champions League club as we were for such a long time under Arsene Wenger. All of these worries, are you then questioning why it is that someone who owns a football club on this trajectory would not do more to halt the direction in which it's going?
That's my hope, is that there will be a realization by the Kroenke family that something needs to be done to stop what is a slow, I wouldn't call, I mean, decline. I mean, we are basically with this stagnation. And stagnation is simply not good enough when everybody's looking to go forward. All the people around you are looking to go forward. So I would hope so that they will realize that actually this is a wonderful asset. It's worth an awful lot of money. We wouldn't mind doing a bit more money with it. So to do that, we need to invest first. And, you know, why not? They might see the light. I wouldn't hold my breath. I am genuinely worried because I'm at the moment, I think we're in this kind of unpleasant situation when something perhaps a bit more spectacular than recruiting a Lorient fullback is required.
Sure.
And I'm not going to I don't think we're going to get much more than a Lorient or a Saint-Étienne fullback or attacking player. Or maybe one guy coming from, I mean, people have been talking about Carrasco. I've got my doubts about him, to be honest.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to get particularly enthused about any of the players. Not any, but some of the players that we have been linked with during the summer have been fairly underwhelming. And the other thing, I suppose, as well, is this, when we heard from Vinay and we heard from Raul about how important the academy was and how it's vital that we create a pathway to first team football for these young players, we can all see that that's a great idea. And if you've got players of enough quality and potential to come through to the first team, then brilliant. But if you're using your academy as a way to make up the numbers or to simply avoid the reality of how you need to operate in the transfer market, then that's not a positive development, is it?
No. And at the moment, amongst the youngsters, I mean, who are we thinking? Willock?
Nelson?
Smith Rowe?
Saka?
Okay.
So there are maybe
I
three
feel
or
tiny,
four.
Tiny little bit better.
Yeah, but they're all, I mean, not to say that that this is a bad thing, but they're all sort of attacking midfielder, wide players. Willock certainly an attacking midfielder, Saka a winger, Smith Rowe could potentially become a, I suppose if you looked at him and thought, who could he be most like in the squad? Well, he's not in the squad anymore, but Aaron Ramsey is the name that springs to mind right there. Reece Nelson, we saw what he could do at Hoffenheim. Defenders, there don't appear to be too many of those coming through. But, you know, there are ways of integrating those players into the squad.
But is it as part of a strategy or is it as part of putting a plaster on a wooden leg? That's the question.
Yeah, that is the question. And, you know, again, we could talk again, Philippe, at the start of August and things could be very different and we could be very impressed by the way that this summer has gone. But, you know, I find it hard not to look at the decisions and the people making the decisions and wonder about the motivation behind those decisions. I mean, maybe it's a case of just this is the reality. They've been told you only have this much money to spend unless you sell or you get more free up more wages. And we all know the obvious ways in which they can do that. So how do you operate? You have to fill a squad, and if you don't have any money to do it, the only way you can do it is by looking internally. I just worry a little that the expectations might be raised too high and that ultimately not enough of these players are either good enough or ready yet to make the step up. And you know, a player can be good enough, but if he's put in at the wrong time, you know, he might
You can kill him.
You can kill him, exactly. That was the word I was going to use. So
what a strong word, but
it is. But I mean, in terms of his career, not actually his life. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the targets, but just in terms of just a very quick question: what is the priority in terms of bringing somebody in? Where is the big priority there for you?
I would say probably every line bar the keeper, even though and the front two, if we can hold on to them. So we're talking, yes. I mean, fullback, I think we have to think as well positively and think that Rob Holding and Hector Bellerin will be back. And if they come back to the level they were at when they were injured, we're going to have two very decent players who are, you know, I have no problems with whatsoever. Then you look around, you know that Laurent Koscielny doesn't have another full season in him. That seems to be, everybody agrees on that. We won't mention Skordan Mustafi, so which leaves us certainly short of a central defender or two.
Mm.
Then you move in midfield, and there is the Xhaka question. Then there is the Ramsey hole, the Ramsey-shaped hole. Then there's the Ozil question mark, the Ozil abyss. So we're talking actually at quite a few players. And perhaps I would add to that one thing. I think we miss dribblers. That's extraordinary to say such a thing.
No, it's not. It's not absolutely not extraordinary. I think it's spot on. We absolutely miss players who can carry the ball rather than pass it in a horseshoe.
Alex is the only one. Alexi Iwobi is the only one who tries that from time to time. And
yeah,
who is still not quite the finished article. But, you know, we compare to all the teams which have got, you know, this capacity of who have these players capable to just go 1v1 or 1v2 and to dribble. We don't have those. And we used to have Alexander Hleb. Remember him? The men who dribbled in circles.
Yes.
Okay, never mind.
But we did, you know, we always had players who could carry the ball. I mean, even Jack Wilshere could carry the ball through midfield. Thomas Rosicki, Alexis Sanchez. People went crazy because he lost the ball a lot, which he did, but he lost the ball. Oxlade-Chamberlain, yeah, to a lesser extent. But, you know, we don't have too many players who play it safe for me at the moment.
Exactly.
And not enough risk takers.
Yes, but risk takers, so what are you going to do? You're going to take a gamble on a young attacking player who's caught your eye, or if you go for one who is an established risk taker, it's going to cost you quite a lot of money. I suppose Carrasco, in a way, is one of those risk takers, even though he was deployed as a wing-back by Martinez with the Belgian team, he's first and foremost. As we remember, because I think, you know, you remember that game against Monaco in the Champions League, is a very quick, fast, aggressive attacker. But he's also somebody who I don't think he will get much better than he is now, and I'm not sure that he's what you call top quality, to quote an old manager of ours.
Yeah, is that not the reality of our situation though, and that these are the kind of players we're going to have to settle for, if you like, because of our status?
Possibly. On the other hand, I see other clubs sometimes managing to attract players of truly great promise and great talent for sums which seem less than what we have to spend to get inferior quality. I mean, maybe it's just, you know, so it can be done.
Yeah.
Look at the way, you know, for example, I mean, some of the, look at the way Lille, for example, do their business. Look at the money they paid for players like Nicolas Pepe, whom everybody's raving about, rightly so.
Yeah.
Look at the money they paid for him. They hardly paid anything.
It's almost as if they have a technical director and a head of recruitment.
It's almost as if they had a really good technical director. Absolutely. And they do.
Yeah.
That's one of the main things. Maybe we should start another rumor going that, but you know, he's not going to leave the club. So there you go. So to get back to you, I think pretty much every single sector of the team, bar the keeper, because I think we should trust Bernd Leno. And up front, if we can keep hold of Aubameyang and Lacazette, you know, which is, you know, front two of some distinction, really.
Yep.
But between the two, there's an awful lot. And you still don't get the feeling that Emery does. I mean, I know that there are no starting 11s these days anymore, but still, you should have an idea of what you want to do. And the team has got to have a certain shape.
Yeah.
And we're still a bit shapeless, and we're sort of shape shifting from one game to the next because of injuries sometimes. Yeah. It's true.
Is there mitigation in the fact that this is his first? Or was his first season in England. There were injuries. He inherited a squad that I think it's fair to say was not correctly balanced. He didn't get any backing in January, even if he was perhaps in some ways culpable for the Denis Suarez loan deal. But next season, not so much the gloves are off, but he has to implement or put his stamp on this squad, both in terms of how it's made up and also the way that it plays.
Yeah. And, well, what can we say about that? Absolutely zilch at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Okay, let me just finish up, because I know I've taken up a fair chunk of your time, but I do want to talk a little bit about some of the players that we have been linked with. And in particular, there have been some young players in France who seem exciting and interesting kind of signings for a club like us who do need to maybe be a bit more, as Raoul said, they need to outsmart the market, but just take a slightly left of center approach to the players that we're bringing in. Before we get on to those, one player who has been linked, it's not quite in the headlines as much as you might expect, but Adrien Rabiot is available on a free transfer from PSG. He's a player that Emery knows. He's a player that we have had contact with in the past. Because he's free, that makes him, saying it again, cost-effective. you know, if we want to bring him in, obviously you would pay him a signing-on fee, which is commensurate with a Bosman and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, is he a realistic target for Arsenal, given we don't have Champions League football? And should he be a target for Arsenal?
I think that he might be out of our reach, and that he would be looking at a Champions League club, especially given that, well, his entourage made loads of noises about an interest of Barcelona. And this interest might have been real, might have not been real, and his entourage has a lot to say for Rabiot and to Rabiot. So I think he would see that as stepping down one level. I am not absolutely sure he's got the kind of character that people would want for the club. That's just me speaking here. I think that, you know, his attitude has been questionable at times, both in his relationship with the club and the way that he prepares for the games. And also he's a player who can on his day look absolutely astonishingly good. That he can do. He's very classy. He can also completely disappear. He's not somebody who is going to bring a lot of iron to a metal-deficient midfield. And he's got to take a very big... he's coming into the best years of his career. He's just... he's turned 24 just a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So his next contract is really super important for him. So I do think that I can understand why people would link him to us, because he's a bit flaky. I've heard that. He would be perfect for us.
Birds of a feather.
What do you mean by that? And with the new Arsenal, that is.
Yeah.
And he might be a bit out of our reach. Okay. You don't want to have a Mesut Ozil Mark II, do you?
That is very true. I don't think anybody has got the energy for that. Tell me a little about William Saliba, who's an 18-year-old central defender. Mm-hmm. Again, somebody we're linked very heavily with. Played a lot for Saint-Étienne this season, and they had a very good season in Liga.
Absolutely, and that's the kind of links that I'm delighted with myself. He's also, somebody who's been He's been playing in every single underage French team, and every time, you know, he was 15, he was playing for the under 17, he was 16, he was playing for the under 18. So he's always been like 1 year ahead of everybody else, and he's physically very, very imposing. I mean, he's 6'4", something like that. I mean, 1.93 meters.
Yeah,
and he's technically good. He's somebody who has good quality when it comes to take the ball out of defense. He's quite brave. And I'm delighted to see a name like this one. I think it's quite an imaginative choice, but I don't think for one second that it would be to join the first team and to play every game. And you know, there are in France people say, well, maybe they could buy him and then loan him back.
What's
yeah,
the point?
I know.
We do need.
So, which is why I'm very happy to hear us linked with him. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, is he really a solution? Or maybe, you know, Emery has seen something in him which makes him believe that he can make the jump from Ligue 1 to Premier League. And that's a big jump to make.
Well, he brought in a player last season who had to make the jump from Ligue 2 to,
that's correct,
to Premier League. So
that's correct. Mm. And hasn't done too badly, by the way.
No, not too badly. Not quite as brilliantly as everybody has said, but in the circumstances, I think pretty well. We talked about dribblers and we talked about players who can carry the ball. And, you know, we brought in Matteo Guendouzi from Lorient last summer. And it looks like we could go back to Lorient for one of their attacking players, for Alexis Claude Maurice. What sort of a player is he? And would he make sense in terms of how this squad might be rebuilt?
I think what would make sense that he's somebody who is fundamentally a goal scoring midfielder.
Yeah,
and we don't have many of those. Actually, do we have one? We had one. He's gone. Mm. I mean, he's also one of those players who's been on the radar for quite a while and has been a regular with France's under 18s and 19s and 20s teams. And but again, we're talking about somebody who is extremely young and he's 21. He's just turned 21.
Yeah.
Just literally like a few days ago. And I don't think he's the kind of player who would necessarily jump into the first 11. So again, not a bad idea at all, but this is not perhaps what we're looking at. I think Saliba would be closer to the first 11 than Maurice would be.
Is there anybody whose name you've spotted doing the rounds this summer who you really think, yes, this is somebody we should definitely be after?
That we've been linked with so far, absolutely nobody, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's fine. That's fine. It's an honest answer to an honest question,
well,
Philippe.
And absolutely. I'm not saying that my nose was exactly, you know, perhaps, smelling the right wind, so to speak. What did I say? That I was particularly following it very closely because, as you said, I've been involved in other things in the last few weeks and months. But I have not heard anything that made my ears prick up and thinking, ooh, gosh, that could be exciting. No.
Right.
I can think of quite a few players that I wouldn't mind bringing to the club, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
Yeah. Ryan Fraser is not getting your juices flowing. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, but again, you know, even when... it's not that long ago, even though they might not... we brought Aubameyang not that long ago.
Yeah,
and Aubameyang was a top player in his league. We brought Alexandre Lacazette, was a top player in his league. We brought Mesut Ozil, was a world champion. We brought Alexis Sanchez, not exactly a poor player. And the names that we are mentioning now are a long, long way away from those, aren't they?
They sure are. They sure are. I don't know if that, you know, if you can make judgments or assessments of a football club based on the players that they're being linked with, but I do think it obviously ties into the performance and the status and the direction in which a football club is going. And I think we all, as much as possible, try to see the bright side of signing young players, and we could bring in this young kid with potential and they can grow and they become valuable assets, and we can do what, you know, maybe what Liverpool did and sell a player we bought for very little for a huge amount and reinvest that back in the squad. But it's sort of like leaving your house to drive to work and expecting every single set of traffic lights to be green.
There are moments when it can work, and I'm thinking in the case of William Saliba, for example. I'm thinking of the case of another French player who came to an English club, which is Issa Diop at West Ham. And I think Issa Diop has been one of the best centre-backs in the division last season. Honestly, I think he's absolutely wonderful, and I wouldn't mind if we bought him. But I don't think they're going to sell him. And it was a little bit the same kind of thing. A very promising player, had gone through the under-18s, under-19s, and so forth, and revealed himself within, you know, in no time at all, that he had the physical and mental capacities to deal with this crazy Premier League. So it might be that we strike lucky. But again, there is a lack. I mean, you need a little bit of, I don't know, luster and excitement.
Yes.
And those names don't really excite me very much. No.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, it's fairly redundant, perhaps, to say that the signings put bums on seats. You know, you know, it's not the only way to build your team. Obviously, there are ways in which you can do it, and it can be progressive and it can be incremental. But when you're a football club that is in a period of stagnation, perhaps decline, you need something. Or very often need something which can just change the mood, because people read into it more than, well, this is more than just a good player that we've signed. It is a show of ambition. It is
it's Dennis after the,
exactly. You know, what happened. It shows you that this is the direction in which we want to go. And I don't know that we're going to get that this summer, but look, we'll see where we are in 2 months' time before the start of the new Premier League season. Maybe the garden, as it looks right now, is a bit overgrown and full of weeds. Maybe it will be rosy, Philippe. Maybe it will.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I'll pray for this. Thank you, Andrew.
The inimitable Philippe Auclair. Thank you very much indeed to him. You know where to follow him. He is on Twitter @Philippe Auclair. And if you want to read the article that we mention in that conversation about all that's going on at FIFA and the Confederation of African Football, you can find the link to it in the show notes. If you're listening to this on your favorite podcasting app, it should be there. Just click in and you can click on the link to the article, or you can visit the podcast episode page on arsblog.com and you'll find a link to the article there too. So I reckon that just about does it for this week. There is probably stuff to talk about more in terms of the fixtures, but I think James and I can cover a bit of that on Monday in the Arscast Extra. And whatever happens over the weekend in terms of transfer news, speculation, rumors, gossip, tittle tattle, and all the rest, we can go through that too. And who knows? Who knows what might happen? Maybe we might sign someone. Maybe we might sell someone. Maybe something will happen. My advice to all of you listening to this, and I thank you very much indeed for being here as always, is don't hold your breath. But some stuff will happen at some point, and when it does, we will talk about it on the podcast and on the blog. Again, thank you very much indeed for being here. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have yourselves a great weekend. Until the next one, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, but mostly gentlemen, of course, Welcome to the FIFA Annual Congress. I am the democratically elected dictator extreme for all time of FIFA here to bring you through this wonderful weekend of events. Many people over the years have said that FIFA is a corrupt organization through which many people have become obscenely wealthy at the expense of the game of football itself. We say very clearly, okay, you got us, but what are you gonna do about it? I've got a secret lair and a gold Concord. You'll never catch me!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.